Next case for argument is PPM Finance versus Narando. That's case number 04-1401. Mr. Quaid.
Good morning. May it please the court.
Wait 1 second. Let everybody get. You notice the clock is an hour ahead. I sat Monday, and at this time it was 2.5 hours ahead, so we're getting better. Okay, Mr. Quaid.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Dennis Quaid. I am counsel for Narando USA, Inc., the appellant in this action. This is an appeal from the judgment of the District Court for the Northern District of Illinois granting summary judgment in favor of Jackson, through its agent, which I'll refer to simply as Jackson, against Narando on the primary complaint, and also granted summary judgment in favor of Jackson on Narando's counterclaim against Jackson and two related entities, which in the briefs we have called the PPM funds. The controversy arises from the sale by Narando of a plant in Alabama to Scottsboro. Jackson and the PPM funds financed Scottsboro's purchase of that plant. In connection with the transaction, Narando granted seller financing for a portion of the price, approximately $7.7 million, to Scottsboro. That amount was represented by a note which was secured by a first lien on the inventory of spare parts necessary to keep the plant in operation. There is a subordination agreement executed between the parties, between Jackson and Narando, which agreement is the cause of the controversy between the parties. Narando seeks a reversal of the judgment of the district court due to errors on questions of fact and questions of law. We believe that the district court made an error in failing to recognize that genuine issues of material fact did exist, which precluded the grant of summary judgment to Jackson. As an example, those questions of law or procedure were the district court's consideration of parole evidence only on the part of Jackson as to the interpretation of the contract. Further, the district court considered parole evidence to interpret a contract which it viewed to be unambiguous. The district court also did not consider the objective evidence offered by Narando to prove that an extrinsic ambiguity did exist in the subordination agreement. If the court had conducted a preliminary finding and did determine that all of the parole evidence that was admissible showed the existence of an extrinsic ambiguity, a question of fact arose, a trial would be necessary, and summary judgment could not happen. Furthermore, the district court erred in determining that the PPM funds were not necessary parties to the primary complaint. We had joined the PPM funds as parties to our counterclaim, and that raised an issue as to whether they were truly necessary. The district court held that they were not. We believe that was error. The essence of the controversy is that the district court found that Narando had breached the subordination agreement by failing to hold in trust payments that were made to it by Scottsboro under the seller financing note, referred to as the subordinated note. Under the terms of the subordination agreement, Narando was entitled to receive those payments so long as there is not a senior default. If there was a senior default, we were not supposed to receive the payments. If we did, we were supposed to hold them in trust and remit them. But the problem was there is no element of knowledge on the part of Narando when the circumstances changed. So I think this case raises three significant points. One, Under the record here, there is a gap in the contract. The subordination agreement is incomplete and failing to require knowledge on the party, Norando, who has to change its conduct and now take a different line of action. Second, there is an extrinsic ambiguity present in the agreement. And third, third issue is the admission that Jackson makes in its brief to this court that it did in fact engage in a course of conduct different and contradictory to the one that it urges is the interpretation of the subordination agreement. That admission supports Norando's assertion of the proper interpretation of the subordination agreement.
Why does the absence of a knowledge requirement mean that there's a gap in the contract? Don't we just assume that the parties meant for there not to be a knowledge requirement?
It's
not there?
Judge Sykes, under the subordination agreement, there is an affirmative duty on the part of Norando to take action contrary to what had been happening. We had received payments before the alleged default. In fact, we received payments for a long time. Many of those payments were not challenged ever by Jackson. But we were supposed to, instead of keeping those payments, we were now supposed to hold those payments in trust and to return them. We were supposed to undertake a conscious action of an affirmative action requiring a consciousness of the different circumstances. We had no knowledge of that. We believe that we would receive a notice due to the definition in the subordination agreement. And in fact, we later did receive such a notice, although 2 years later.
But those are two different agreements. The subordination agreement, that's different in the subordination agreement. There was an explicit requirement that Norando provide Jackson with subordinated default notice, and it was silent with respect to the senior default notice from Jackson to Norando. Isn't that right?
The written terms are silent as to Jackson giving Norando a notice, yes. It was the understanding of Norando that such a notice would be required. We believe the course of conduct of Jackson shows that such a notice would be required.
Well, Norando specifically asked for that senior default notice provision in the negotiations with Jackson, and Jackson refused to include it, and Norando executed the agreement anyway. Isn't that right, or did I get the facts?
You have the facts correct, Judge Williams, but that does not show that Norando agreed with that interpretation of the agreement or that contractual set of rights and obligations.
But you're asking for that notice provision to be implied in the contract when it was a bargain for,
right,
or attempt to bargain for, a clause that was rejected.
We do believe that it was actually a part of the agreement because we asked that it be explicitly made. We don't believe that means it's not a part of the agreement. And
yeah, but in order for us to fill in the gap, it has to be something that the parties didn't contemplate. And here the parties contemplated it. Rejected it.
Only one party rejected.
One rejected.
A gap can exist when there's not a mutual intent of both parties on a point. And that's not only because that point is unforeseen, it's also due to the fact that the point is troublesome to the parties and may lead to a failure of the agreement, according to the Restatement of Contracts, Section 204, and Professor Farnsworth. So it's not just because of the disagreement between the parties doesn't mean there is no gap.
Well, clearly it's not in there, but I'm saying it was contemplated. I mean, we only have the authority to fill in the gap when it was something that wasn't anticipated.
Your Honor, you have the authority to fill in the gap when there is an essential term that's missing in the agreement. There is no intent to not require notice or knowledge on the part of Norando. And there is no provision in the agreement saying that notice was not required or knowledge was not required. It didn't. The subordination agreement didn't say that, come hell or high water, if you excuse the expression, that we had to return the payment.
So you want us to correct what is now very clear, Norando's lapse in executing the agreement without that provision?
Your Honor, I want, we would ask the court to add this term to it. Yes, we don't believe it's a lapse. We believe that Jackson deliberately left this provision out of the agreement. They were the drafter of the agreement. They engaged in a course of conduct for 2 years where they facilitated the making of the payments by Scottsboro to Norando.
But Norando read the agreement, right, after it was drafted by Jackson?
Yes, so we read it. We proposed a series of changes, all of which were rejected on a take-it-or-leave-it basis.
Mm-hmm. Does that restatement section that you cited, counsel, stand for the proposition that a term that one side tried and failed to get included in a contract can later be implied by the court?
Judge, like the comments to Section 204 do indicate that there may be an omission of a term due to the feeling of the parties or one of the parties that that term may be so controversial that it may cause the failure of the negotiations. So I believe the answer is that even under these circumstances, the court has the authority and the duty to provide a solution to fill the gap.
And why even negotiate for a term if failure to include it can lead a court to imply that it should be there? You'd probably be in better shape if you hadn't negotiated for it.
Judge Evans, I don't know if we would or would not. We tried to have the agreement reflect what we thought was the best and most efficient method for handling the situation. We acted in good faith on that point. I think we would have been more remiss if we had not sought to make the change in the agreement.
And what is the best case you've cited that have facts similar to our case here on this point? I know you cited restatement. What do you think is your best case that's closest to our situation? Because I didn't see one that was that close to our situation.
Where you
negotiated it, it didn't get in it, and now you want us to fill in the gap.
Judge Williams, I don't know that there's any case on all fours on this point. I think the cases which we have cited in the brief.
Yeah, but what's the closest? What's on all threes?
Your Honor, I don't know that there's any case that even comes to all threes on the negotiation point.
Okay.
But there are, the cases do stand for the proposition that courts, that the parties do not contemplate all the contingencies, and often do not agree, but that the gap does exist when there is a lack of mutual intent of the parties on an essential term. The other point that we believe is essential is the fact that there existed an extrinsic ambiguity in the agreement as to the Section 2.5 as to whether payments were not permitted to be made. Those are the payments that Jackson has sued for the return, some 15 payments. Jackson takes the position that the agreement is the sole authority to determine what payments were permitted or not permitted to be made. We offered objective evidence to the court to show that there is an extrinsic ambiguity on this point. The court did not consider our evidence. The court did consider the evidence of Jackson to show that its attorneys who drafted the agreement had rejected our tendered changes, as we have just discussed, but the district court could not make that determination on summary judgment. It could not consider parole evidence when it said the agreement was unambiguous. It could not consider the parole evidence of one party, especially when that one party's evidence was self-serving and therefore inadmissible. And I would point out to the court that the record does show the objective evidence of Norando that which is based on the testimony of Jackson's employee and Scottsboro's employee, that Jackson engaged in a course of conduct in his workout with Scottsboro to enable, not only to permit, but to enable the payments to continue to Narando for a period of 15 months. Without question, they even lent additional money to Scottsboro so that money could be used to make the additional payments. But they say that they can lend money, they can consent, they can waive defaults on a limited basis. So Narando is going to receive payments, but then they can ask for it back. And in the meantime, in this long period of time, what was happening is that Narando's collateral position, where we had a first lien on the inventory of spare parts, was declining each month, each day. So the lengthy process that Jackson used to conduct this workout, when it withheld any knowledge of the existence of a default from Narando, was done at the expense of Narando. Our collateral went down. We thought we were receiving payments that we could retain, and Jackson was playing both sides of the street on this issue. They were saying now that, well, you can't keep the payments because of these provisions, but they were helping the payments to be made. They knew they needed our cooperation. We kept the plant in operation by virtue of those spare parts. This max of opportunistic conduct, where they were taking advantage of us, it violates the implied duty of good faith, and it should not be permitted under these circumstances or any circumstances. The admission that
how much of the $76 million that Jackson gave for the purchase of the plant went to Narando?
Judge Evans, the total loan by Jackson and its affiliates, the PPNM funds, was approximately $125 million in total. Approximately $85 million of that went to Narando at the time of the closing. Narando also received the seller note for an additional $7.7 million. We transferred ownership of the plant to them and to Scottsboro, and a lien was taken on the plant by Jackson. It was a large transaction.
Sure. Let me just ask that, because your question implied that they're really taking advantage of your position.
Well, Your Honor, I think they did take advantage of us. I think that the omission of the notice provision from the subordination agreement was intentional. There's a lot of money
sure
on the table.
It apparently was intentional, but so what?
We believe so, and we believe that raises a violation of the duty of good faith not to take opportunistic advantage of withholding the knowledge of the default for over 2 years while our collateral is going down, and they're trying to rehabilitate Scottsboro to increase their recovery. And I think that their admission in their brief on page 48 that they normally allow subordinated lenders to receive payments, as they not only allowed Narando to receive payments, but also to facilitate those payments by waivers and by making additional loans, shows this course of conduct. I think that goes to the issue of both the requirement of knowledge and also the opportunistic conduct that was going on.
Did the opportunistic conduct consist of the refusal to agree to that contract term or something that happened afterwards?
Judge, it's like, you know, after the closing, in the course of performance, the opportunistic conduct was taking the position, at least now, that the payments had to be returned without knowledge on our part.
That's what the contract says, though. The contract permits that. That's why I'm asking the question.
The word
position that it was opportunistic to to refuse to agree to the notice provision or the knowledge provision, or was it something else?
No, there's a different rationale when you're negotiating an agreement than afterwards. We believe, and we believe the evidence shows, that due to the course of conduct of Jackson, that knowledge was required, notice to us was required, because they never asked for the money during this period. A default occurred in October of 1999. Payments were being made to us each month after that. They never asked for it back. In fact, they didn't ask for it back until they filed this complaint. They sent a notice. That was only in late July of 2001, right before they pushed Scottsboro into bankruptcy.
Isn't there a non-waiver provision in this contract that is pretty ironclad?
There is a non-waiver provision, Your Honor. I'm out of time, but to finish the question, we're not, on this point, we're asserting the affirmative conduct of Jackson as opposed to an omission that would be covered by the non-waiver. Thank you.
Mr. Levin?
Good morning. My name is Forrest Lammerman. I'm here on behalf of Jackson, the principal lender, and also on behalf of the other senior lenders, the PPM funds. I feel like I'm halfway back in Wisconsin today, since I recognize at least two of the panel from my prior existence in Milwaukee. This case really revolves around whether the agreement that parties agreed to back in February of 1999 can be and should be enforced. The subordination agreement was part of a larger transaction. Under that transaction, Randall sold its aluminum processing company to a third party, Scottsboro. Scottsboro paid for the majority of the purchase price of $92 million by borrowing funds from the senior lenders, principally Jackson, and to a lesser extent, the PPM investment funds. The parties were represented on both sides by sophisticated counsel. Latham and Watkins represented the lenders. Narando was represented by their counsel of choice in this country, the Thompson Hine firm from Cleveland. There were a number of agreements. One was the credit agreement between Scottsboro and the senior lenders. Under that agreement, funds were made available that allowed the closing to take place. As part of that closing, there was also a subordinated note, because the price could not be paid in full from the lending. There also had to be some seller financing for the minority of the price, $7.8 million. To allow that, the senior lenders required, as is customary in such transactions, that there be a subordination. And an express subordination agreement was signed. Before it was signed, it was reviewed by Mr. Nassinger from the Thompson Hine firm representing Narandel. Contrary to the implications of my opponent, there was not a laundry list, at least, that Mr. Nassinger could testify about as to what changes he asked. The only change he could remember asking was he asked for a senior default provision to be included so that notice would have to be given if there was a default under the credit agreement that would not permit payments to be accepted or retained under the subordinated note by Narando. And that request was specifically rejected by Latham and Watkins on behalf of the senior lenders.
And that request was rejected, and so is not certainly in the subordination agreement. So why did you send such a notice to Narando on July 27, 2001?
That notice was sent because we were on the eve of bankruptcy, and even if payments had been received earlier, they weren't going to be received anymore. And that question, Your Honor, may go to another point that Mr. Mr. Quaid raised, and that was the idea that merely as a lender facilitating the payments by allowing payments to be made under the line of credit to a variety of payees, including Narandl, somehow it was opportunistic or improper. Let me suggest that, in fact, the non-waiver provisions and other provisions of the subordination agreement allow precisely for this kind of latitude on the part of the senior lenders. And I'll go through fairly quickly. Reading an agreement is not the most entertaining or informative exercise, but let me just quickly indicate where I think the pressure points are. Mr. Quaid indicated that he thought there was something wrong with the fact that subsequent to the closing, there was some additional lending made possible through, not through Jackson actually, but through the PPM funds, a bridge loan that helped keep Scottsboro alive. But Section 3 on page 6 of the subordination agreement precisely allows for that. Modifications of the senior debt can be done under any terms, and no permission or notice is needed from or to the subordinated creditors. This is the right of the senior lender to do this. Paragraph 4 makes it abundantly clear that the agreement will be effective even if various rights under the agreement and under the senior debt are modified in some way or impaired. Specifically, paragraph 4.D says that the terms of this subordination agreement and the subordination affected hereby and the rights of the parties shall not be affected, modified, or impaired in any manner by, and then section D is, shall not be affected by any exercise or non-exercise of any right, power, or remedy under or in respect of the senior debt. So the lender had the right to go ahead and let payments be made. And that's what these anti-waiver provisions provide for. Similarly, there's a very strong anti-waiver provision in paragraph 7 that includes the idea that in the first part of paragraph 7, that the lender can select rights and enforce selectively in such order and as often as the lenders may deem expedient. They can use their judgment about what they're going to do and not do as lenders. Any failure or delay on the part of any party in exercising their rights under the agreement also does not constitute a waiver. Any waiver has to be in writing, is what paragraph 8 tells us, or it's not effective and it has to be signed by all of the parties. So I think the complaint here is that having made an agreement that made financial sense and having agreed to it, in fact, even on the notice issue, Narandl's own brief at page 16 and 17 says that they assented to the notice provision not being included in the agreement. They assented to it. That's a meeting of the minds. They may want to call it something else. It's not perhaps a happy meeting of the minds. Not everyone walks away from a meeting of the minds pleased with every aspect of what they've negotiated, but it's a meeting of the minds. Having reached a deal that made imminent financial sense and that garnered Narandl $84 million, they would like subsequently to have the deal be different, and in a variety of ways they've tried to imply that there must be a notice requirement that is a part of the transaction, or that the court should invent one or rewrite an agreement. There are a number of cases that describe the gap-filling argument. We thought the gap-filling argument was raised sort of late in the day, but be that as it may, it doesn't make sense. There's no gap here. Moreover, as the court noted, the cases in which judges are inclined to fill gaps are where circumstances arise that the parties could not reasonably have known about or contemplated at the time they did the transaction. Or, as with the case that was sent to the court yesterday, there's something that agreed to explicitly by the parties, but there's some aspect of it that's missing. I believe the case that was sent to the court was an employment agreement, or focused on an employment agreement, under which there was an agreement that the employee would receive 1% of the stock of a corporation, but it didn't say what class of stock and at what time or when it would be exercisable and when the right would vest. So there was an agreement, but obviously the parties forgot to fill in a detail. Nothing like that happened here. Nor is it unusual or unfair that a senior lender will not look immediately to take payments back or to prevent payments to be made from being made to a junior party. That typically will put a company, that is the borrower, into another set of defaults with another creditor. What Jackson did, and what many other secured creditors would do and have the right to do under similar circumstances, was to look first and foremost to their borrower. And only when it became sadly evident that Scottsgrove could not pay did they turn then to their rights under the subordination agreement and exercise those rights. Mr. Quaid asks how Narandl could know that there were defaults. Part of this, of course, is how Narandl chose to manage its own risks. It knew, certainly its counsel knew, that it was not entitled to receive a notice of any default under the credit agreement. And I suppose what it could have done would have been to ask Scottsboro. Scottsboro might have been eager not to make the payments under the circumstances, but it did not ask. There was some awareness that Scottsboro was in trouble. There is undisputed testimony from Ed Darnell, an officer of Narandl, who was the officer who was present at the closing, that he and other members of the industry were well aware when Scottsboro had a lockout of its workforce. That's when the defaults began, by the way, not surprisingly, in the fall of 1999, and that he asked Scottsboro whether it nonetheless would continue to make the sub-note payments and was assured that they would. But there's nothing in the testimony that indicates that any of those questions resulted in a question like, are you in default as a result of this lockout? Risk management could have been handled by either asking or by refusing to take payments without a certification from Narandl if they were not in default, pardon me, from Scottsboro, if they were not in default under their credit agreement. Or it could be done in the way in which it was done. Remain ignorant, take the payments, and see if the senior lender ever needs them. After all, the senior lender might have been paid if the attempts to restructure and work out the situation had been successful, if the market had changed in the aluminum industry. If that had happened, Narandl would never have been exposed to the possibility or the reality of having to pay back the payments it agreed to pay back if these things happened, and they did happen. Mr. Quaid refers to objective or extrinsic evidence of ambiguity in the contract. I don't think there is any such extrinsic evidence. There's not, as in the Raffles case, there's not two ships called Peerless here. The terms of the agreement are quite clear. There's nothing in the outside world that, as Judge Posner pointed out in AIM International, confers a special meaning and a term that appears to be unambiguous. The only situations that are referred to are the presence of an unused definition of senior default notice in the agreement, but that's just a definition. It confers no substantive rights, as the district court noted. And the only other objective evidence offered by Narandl was the fact that we gave a default notice on the eve of bankruptcy, as Judge Williams asked us about. But nothing in that notice says anything other than what's said in the agreement itself. In fact, it is simply a paraphrase of a paragraph of the agreement. The subordinated creditor, Narandl, was on notice by virtue of the agreement it signed that the senior creditors had the right to come back later. and that the senior creditors had the right to demand the return of payments, that these payments not be retained if they were received while there was a default under the agreement. That happened, and the contractual rights may be enforced. We quote in one of our briefs a case from Illinois, I almost said Wisconsin, that says something like parties should be free to enforce their contractual rights without risking being mulcted for a lack of good faith. There's no bad faith here, and there's no course of dealing between the parties that in any way affected or changed the agreement. In fact, the testimony from all sides is clear that these parties had nothing to do with one another. From the time of the closing in February of 1999 until 4 days before Scottsboro's bankruptcy, which occurred on August 1, 2001, the parties did not communicate with one another in any way. This is not like the situation where parties sign up a deal, as in the construction industry, for example, and then as they deal with each other constantly in the course of creating a building, they make changes to the deal. There were no changes. The parties simply signed an agreement, left the closing room, and never talked to one another again until the issue of whether there had to be repayment occurred. There's nothing unfair about that. That's what the agreement requires and provides for, and exercising contractual rights is not bad faith and it's not opportunistic. Nor would it be good to reward people for knowing that they have agreed to a subordination agreement, and that the subordination agreement does not include a notice provision, that the request for a notice provision has been expressly rejected, and then allow the party who signs the agreement knowing that to come back and ask courts to rewrite the agreement to include what expressly was not there. I guess the last point wasn't dealt with at length by Mr. Quaid was the issue of whether or not the PPM funds were necessary parties. The PPM funds were not necessary parties to this at all. They were not even joined as plaintiffs in any way. Supplemental jurisdiction under 1367A exists wherever, whenever the same case and controversy involves additional parties. The Narandle subsequently joined the PPM funds 7 or 8 months after the case began, joined them only as counter defendants. There are certain limited exceptions to supplemental jurisdiction under 1367B, but none of them applies here. They are really situations where someone who should have been a plaintiff is non-diverse and should be joined. But the funds really have no economic stake in this. Narandle, for the first time in its reply brief, raised the notion that there must be a per se rule. They don't really say that, but a per se rule that any party to a contract that is the subject of the dispute must be joined. That's really not the case, and there are no cases that they cited for that effect. Most of the cases in this jurisdiction say that considerations of necessary party status turn on the specific facts of a case, and we can provide those cases to the court if they're deemed to be appropriate. Narandle itself really didn't believe, apparently, that every party to the subordination agreement had to be joined as a party, as a necessary party, because one of the parties is Scottsboro, and neither of us have thought to join Scottsboro because they have no economic stake in the outcome. The same thing is true of the PPM funds. The PPM funds have no stake in the outcome of this case because under the intercreditor agreement between Jackson as the most senior lender and the PPM funds as the secondary lenders, Jackson gets everything that comes in until and unless Jackson has been paid in full, and there was uncontradicted, unrebutted testimony that Jackson was owed, and they still are owed, at least $11.5 million, far more than the amount that's at stake in this case. Therefore, the only parties that are needed in this case are Jackson as a lender who can collect these payments, and Randall as the party who's obligated to pay them. Thank you.
Mr. Quaid, your time has expired, but we'll give you a minute because we used some of your light time there for some questions.
Thank you, Your Honor. On the necessary parties issue, which goes to jurisdiction, there's no need to name Scottsboro. They had no interest. They were the obligor. But the PPM funds were lenders. They were trust beneficiaries. They had a right to sue. That is why they were necessary parties. In terms of extrinsic evidence, there was extrinsic evidence of an ambiguity. It was Jackson's own conduct in giving us the notice and engaging in the process to facilitate the payments to be made to us. All of that goes to show an ambiguity. And we did not believe on our side that we were not entitled to a notice. As Mr. Lammerman has indicated, we thought we were entitled to it. That is the basis of the ambiguity. Also, Your Honor, this case raises the possibility of creating a precedent where the court would sanction allowing a party to agree to one thing but engage in a different course of action. I don't think that should be permitted. Thank you, Your Honor.
Case will be taken under advisement.